All right. Good morning. It is Wednesday. It is the 14th of August, and you are on the Gareth Cliff Show on the Real Network. We have Jack Butlante here, and we also have the fantastic Timothy Maurice. Now, he's a speaker and author. For those who don't know, he's also applied neuroscience and behavioral psychology to all kinds of work. He hosts the Brain and Brand Show, which is on the podcast party. You can go and find that, like and subscribe and everything else too. And he joins us on the show this week to discuss a whole lot of stuff. I've been lucky enough to know Timothy for a long time, and I've never had a boring conversation with him. I've never sat with Timothy and gone, you know, it's really warm today, or traffic was hard, or you know, if the economy is really bad, or what do you think of politics? Because we don't want to talk about that stuff. And when I'm around you, I feel like we could talk about the really cool, interesting shit and not have to worry about the boring stuff.
Yeah, especially and not worry about being boxed, right?
Absolutely.
Like, it's okay to have a interesting conversation without being put in a box where you're going, well, if you said that, that means you're this.
So typically, if a conversation is interesting, it has to step outside of that box.
Yeah, exactly.
Many things I want to talk to you about this morning, but you make your own espresso when we don't have, because the little barista station isn't open early in the morning.
Yeah.
So you made your own plan there.
Yeah, it's like at the end of the day, the placebo effect is powerful. Like I am fully convinced I'm drinking an espresso.
Even though it's just instant.
It's instant. But that's instant to you, not me.
Like, right. Yeah.
This is an espresso. I learned this. Like, you go to places like in the bush, they don't have fancy machines.
No.
Mm-hmm. But I love an espresso. It's the one thing that I'm bougie in. Coffee. I go to coffee tastings. I can tell you the difference between Ugandan, Ethiopian.
Really?
Yeah. Like, okay. When I smell a bean, it's a spiritual experience.
But if you're bougie, if you're bougie about it, you're not uptight about drinking that rubbish.
No, because I had to employ the placebo effect.
Okay, but that's amazing. So is this a technique that you've learned with your brain?
Yeah.
Or is it something that we're all capable of? Or is it something that you just realize is bullshit and you just sit there and take it?
My man, like, Gareth, if doctors are convincing people who thought they had a knee surgery that they felt like they had a knee surgery and they convinced them and they get up off the table and start walking, and they didn't do anything to the knee. They just put a cut mark. Right. Exactly. Like, there's so much we can do to hack our brain. And that's the fundamental. I've been on about this since right before COVID, that you can employ design techniques. I'll give you a good example. If you're trying to lose weight, for example, you guys don't need to lose weight. But if you are listening, you're trying to lose weight, you do what Google does. They design the offices in a way that hack people's brains so they eat healthier. So here's an example. Because we're so lazy and we only want to spend so much energy throughout the day, then you can put the unhealthier stuff higher or lower because our brains will default to what's at eye level on average. Yes, there will be horrible shit days where you go up high, you go down low, but on average, so when I want to drink less alcohol, I just put it up a little bit higher.
Really?
Yes.
And it works.
Yes, it works.
Does this?
I'm blown away by it. Like, it works on me and I know what I'm doing.
Does this happen in stores where they put the stuff at eye level? That stuff sells faster than
Yes, and they put it right at the end of the purchase. All of that. It's all design. It's behavioral psychology. And so I use it on myself. So that's why I have an espresso.
All right. I listened to, and I haven't heard a lot of his podcast, to be perfectly honest, and people are going to be horrified by this, but it's the only podcast of Simon Sinek's that I listened to. And someone sent it to me because I had a meeting on Monday and they said, you've got to hear this. He talked to a woman who's a nose. You know, when you talked about your bougie coffee.
Yeah.
This woman she has a heightened sense of smell.
Yes.
Which I think you can develop, but she was born with this ability. She can smell across the room what kind of cologne you've got on.
Yeah.
And she designs scents for brands.
Nice.
Now, it sounds like bullshit, right? But if you think
about
it.
But not to me.
No, I mean, this is a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So she's designed these scents for, you know, Mercedes-Benz, for Adidas, for Louis Vuitton, for Gucci. You go into a Western hotel anywhere in the world, it smells the same. And she's the woman behind this because she's realized the only part of your brain that is exposed is the nerve that goes into the olfactory system.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That's the only part of your brain that's actually exposed to the elements.
Mm.
And it goes directly into the midbrain and gets registered as a feeling and a memory straight away.
Yeah.
And that's why if you smell a certain perfume, you're in love with a girl. Every time you smell that perfume, you'll think of her instantly, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
I did a whole podcast about this. Do you know about the smell dating series?
No, tell us.
Where men wore t-shirts. Well, this was for heterosexual couples. Mm-hmm. Men wore t-shirts for the full day with no fragrance or cologne. Put the t-shirts on the table. Women came along and smelled one, go, And then they go into the next one. They go into the next one. Whichever smell they connect to, they choose that number and reach out to that person for a date. And study shows that people who choose their partner based on smell have a better chance of survival. The reason why is because you're smelling chemistry. Your body's producing, from your diet, produce odor.
Yeah. Like pheromones.
Your pheromones and all of this stuff. So the craziest thing is, and I've noticed this as a vegan, I am literally like putting people off recently. Because people are literally into smell of meat. And they don't realize it. People are no longer inviting me to the braai anymore. People are like, you smell terrible.
But
you smell
like vegan. Well, the amazing... Why would someone invite you to a braai?
So this is amazing because...
Whatever.
There is a certain smell which every person in the world... There are obviously exceptions to this, but mostly across all cultures, age groups, income levels, whatever. There's one smell that all humans love and that all humans hate. You want to guess what the one is that they love?
Probably. I think most humans are drawn to flowers.
You're close, but that's not it. You want to guess, Jack?
I'd say chocolate.
Also, if you took somewhere in between, vanilla is the
vanilla.
Okay. One's like, ugh, vanilla. The reason is that there's a chemical in breast milk. Or in formula. Mm-hmm. So even if you weren't raised on breast milk, makes you feel like, you know, mom, safety. No matter how old or young you are, you can remember that. And vanilla hits those notes for you.
Nice.
The one that we all hate is the smell of decaying human flesh.
Yeah.
It instantly will put a person off. You can smell it from a long way away. We're extremely sensitive to it. And that's not surprising, right?
Yeah, not at all.
Death is obviously...
Was all this in the podcast?
Yeah, so this woman spoke about this, and then she said every scent has a color, which is interesting too.
Yeah.
Like if I say yellow, most people would smell lemon or blossoms of some kind. Mm. If I said green, they would smell that earthy kind of after the rain smell or that woodiness, the moss, that kind of thing. So I found it fascinating because it got me thinking about you. And I mean, you've done some fascinating stuff about the way the brain works and the way that we remember stuff and the way that humans, I mean, sometimes so much of it is subconscious, right?
Most of it. That's the whole point. It's like we have no clue what levers are driving our behavior, right? I think it's one of the biggest inhibitors to inclusion and getting along is things like smell. You know, you're sitting across from someone who has a vastly different diet, and that community of people eat and experience life differently. And we don't realize it's the unconscious stuff. It's the sensory elements that the fact that they're wearing a kippah versus a cross. And you don't even realize that the kippah threw you off in a way. And so I'm interested in how do we redesign spaces, environments, smells to hack this bullshit. That's my interest. It's like when I go into office and I'm working with leaders, I'm going, it's the little things. I'll tell you a funny story about this Afrikaans guy who had been assigned a young team of talented black guys. Mm-hmm. And I was brought in from Baller World to
He's
look
like,
at this.
I need all the help I can get.
Yes. Well, this guy. So this guy was the archetypical military guy. He had a mustache that turned up on the side.
Oh, wow. And like the Kaiser.
He would literally sit in meetings and stare at these guys when they were talking through strategy and twisting his mustache with this sort of menacing grimace. But he was the best in his field. And it would have been a detriment to the business to get rid of this guy.
Yeah.
Like he was sharp, insanely sharp. You know, one of these like rare kind of geniuses. Mm-hmm. So he was that guy. And after speaking to him a few minutes, it took me no time to realize he had nothing against these guys.
Yeah.
He was just ready to get down to business. Like, and those guys were also brilliant. So you've got these brilliant young black guys and this brilliant Afrikaans guy who couldn't get along because of the simple stuff.
So how did you put them together?
So I watched them and I observed them, and I realized there was a moment, there was a nexus between greeting and the hard stuff that they didn't see. And I sat with him and I said, do you realize that if you put your arm down, you open yourself up to them? And he says, so how am I going to do that? Because I'm so, it's like a habit to twist my mustache. And I said, well, it's up to you. If you can figure out a way to put your arm down, it will change everything. He comes back the next week. He's cut that side of his mustache off.
Wow, he's committed, huh?
He was committed. Jeez. And changed everything. They became this world-class team. This is a true story.
Wow.
It's the simple things. And instead of people sitting around going, oh, he doesn't like black people and black people don't like, it's just bullshit. It's a way to hack all of this stuff to get into your unconscious mind to free yourself from this nonsense.
But you know, like, as you're saying, it's the simple things. I'm thinking about how many stimuli we come across on a day-to-day basis. It sounds like a lot to keep track of.
Yeah. It is.
When I think about how I interact with
our brains are not people, designed to have this much going on.
It's an overload.
I mean, these things just like it's a nonstop barrage, and a primitive man wouldn't have had more than two important things happen in a day.
Precisely, yeah.
You know, it took you so long to get from here to there.
But that's why people are cheating at such an extraordinary level today. Because if you think about it, my parents, I always say to my dad, I'm like, you guys have been together 51 years this year. And I'm like, if you had the options I had on social media, you guys would have left each other a long time ago.
That's right. Yes.
You were basically stuck with each other.
Right. I mean, like,
you knew five people.
The number of pictures on Instagram and all, it's warped our sense of reality, because an average guy, for argument's sake, does not think of their life partner in the same specs that any of our parents did. Because our parents didn't have all these different pictures and images and magazines that they would then compare to the real people that they deal with. Mm. Whereas today, like, it's not too much of a stretch of the imagination that I could pull up my phone and look at something on Instagram and bump into something pretty similar in Sandton City.
Well, let me give you one of the reasons why, genetically, why this is a problem. So when women are ovulating, they're drawn to stronger genes. Mm. And this is very controversial. So they typically, we're using heterosexual couples, you know, for the one of the biggest challenges we face is that we're not aware of the fundamentals on how our genes are driving us to navigate complexity. So let me simplify this. So at the end of the day, one of the strongest instincts in human nature is to pass on genes, to advance the best genes, to ensure that your bloodline survives, to pass on, to strengthen the bloodline, to contribute back to the bloodline. This is why they used to engineer societies, right? They wanted to make sure that you pass on the best and get rid of the worst. Mm-hmm. This is what the thinking was.
It's like breeding good racehorses.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Now, when a woman is ovulating, they're attracted to stronger genes. But you typically marry someone with average genes, someone more congenial, someone easier to get along with. So inherent during ovulation is a conflict. Hmm. The conflict is, I'm with this extraordinary, lovely, nice person, but he's not making my hormones pop. Hmm. Now, in doing this ovulation period, I'm much more interested in the bad boy who's tall, who's got these extraordinary shoulders and jawlines and so forth, who's running rapid, just running wild. It's an unconscious instinctual attraction. It's magnetic.
Hmm. So watch your women during their ovulation. That's what I'm hearing. But also, if you're the kind of guy who finds you getting a lot of attention from a girl and it's that time of the month, maybe you got some strong genes.
Yeah. Yeah. But let me just say this. It's funny. I've worked with women dedicated my career to my mother. My mother and my father worked the same job, but my dad got paid more. So I was always interested in the gender pay gap and those dynamics. And so I was like, I've worked with Destiny Magazine for over 10 years, Forbes Woman, etc., applying these interests in neuroscience. And I would be sitting across from women, and I'd feel during at certain times during certain consultations, I'd feel this like magnetic pull. And because I understand this, I knew it had nothing to do with me. It could have been any like decent guy that was sitting across from her. Mm. And it kept me from so much chaos because I didn't internalize it as she wants me.
So many guys are just getting off on this.
They're like, they see a woman in the office, and this is why so many people are cheating at work.
Yeah.
Is that people assume she wants me because during ovulation, women dress differently.
Right.
They show a little bit more cleavage because their body is signaling.
Wear a bit more red.
Exactly. And all these studies have been sort of replicated and repeated. But that's not the bigger point. The bigger point is we don't know this is happening. So you are observing online, and most people are posting their best, most fertile self.
Mm-hmm.
And the person you're living with on a daily basis.
Isn't that?
If you look at the aggregate of that person, you are experiencing 90% of the time their average self. Mm. Yes, they come out every so often to an event, but you're experiencing the average self. Because you're experiencing the average self, you are unfairly measuring the person you have an affair with. That person is only presenting you their best, most fertile self. They're calling you during the time of the month where their body is popping. Because one more last thing on this thing of women doing ovulation. Their breasts firm up, their eyes become more symmetrical. This is where makeup comes from. Makeup is an attempt to mimic ovulation.
Oh, really? Mm.
Yeah. So what that whole idea is that the cheeks become rosier, the lips become fuller. So makeup is mimicking that.
Huh.
So push-up bras is mimicking that. The whole idea is that we're trying to pursue, and all of us, men, we're doing the same thing. We're trying to pursue our most fertile self.
An always-on approach.
Yes. Mm, and let me just deal with the men for a second.
Yes.
Why is it a tragedy when we're going bald? Are you going bald?
No.
You're not going bald?
No.
Let me see. Prove it. Okay. I'm looking at your hairline a little bit. How many more years do you think you've got?
Prove it.
Let me see. Prove it.
How many more years do you think you've got of a strong hairline? Is in your family, in other words,
is
receding hairline in your family?
No, we've just got really big foreheads.
You got really big foreheads, so you're not worried?
Not at all.
Okay, so most people, when we're wearing a cap, is because we're worried.
Do you see what that cap says?
Yeah, okay, cool. We're trying to signal youth. When a man is going bald, it's a tragedy to our signaling power. Mm-hmm. Because the assumption is you're losing testosterone, you're losing your fertile power, you're losing your ability. That's why you see men doing all kinds of stuff. We've even started wearing wigs now.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So it's not just women that are signaling.
Men are those planes that are coming back from Turkey with all the guys with bandaged heads. They're just trying to prolong the...
Exactly.
So is that a sign? Is baldness a sign that you're losing testosterone? It doesn't have to be, is it?
It doesn't have to be. But what my point is that... Typically, one of the reasons why we don't like a big gut is because it's assigned unconsciously to our genes that person is storing a lot of cortisol and stress.
Oh, yeah. Not that they've given up.
No, yeah. But part of that's a symptom.
Right.
And so the simple idea is that all of these signals, once you get in my new book, I'm writing two books simultaneously, and it's a bit ridiculous what I'm trying to pull off.
Yeah.
But the idea is that if you look at your fertility curve. And anyone who's questioning this, I want you to think about this for a second. If a 5-year-old child is wearing a miniskirt and makeup, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Mm. It's almost disgusting. Why? They're not in their fertility window yet.
Right.
If an 85-year-old person, I don't care how liberated you are, if they walk around with a miniskirt and makeup and cleavage popping, it's just a bit awkward.
Yeah.
You 80, can.
85? I mean, Jane Fonda, up to a while ago, she could have still done that. She can't do it now.
Even J-Lo is starting to look a little bit ridiculous because the question is, why are you signaling fertility so hard?
Yeah.
If you're not in your fertility window.
Right.
Yeah. Barren.
So this is very, you're crazy. This is very controversial, but here's the bigger point. The bigger point is because we don't understand, we're talking about the subconscious. We don't understand that the unconscious mind is constantly trying to signal. And the people who look the best align their image with what's happening inside of their body.
Uh-huh. Mm.
This is where it gets real interesting.
Oh, wow.
It's that's authenticity. If I am 70 years old and I'm constantly putting hair dye in, and if I look really good, it's still a little awkward. There's nothing like someone who aligns their external expression with what's happening with their hormones and their internal makeup on the inside.
Mm-hmm. Just rock your gray hair.
Well, what about the fact that there are pressures now that we never really had in any society? Look, there are still societies that value their elders, that put a lot of stock in wisdom and experience, and regard people with gray hair or no hair or people who've lived a long time as being the people you should go to for advice. Mm-hmm. But because of Hollywood, maybe, and because in America in particular, and I'm not knocking your home country, but there seems to be a worship of youth.
Yeah.
To the degree where we would rather listen to the Hawk Tour girl than listen to somebody who's really seen a lot, done a lot, been there, done that, understands the world a whole lot better. We don't value that person.
Yeah, youth is a prize because it's vitality. It signals survival. You know, one of my favorite studies was done at the University of Toronto, where they put a ring around the penis and attached it to a computer, and they put like a little egg with a wire attached in a woman's vagina, and they flashed images across the screen really, really fast. So you could only pick up the images in your unconscious mind. And a woman did this study, by the way. Uh-huh. And whatever the penis became erect to is what you were really drawn to. And whatever there was arousal and wetness in the woman, that's what they were really drawn to. So they gave you a battery of questions prior to the test to say, what are you drawn to? Are you drawn to this? Mm-hmm. In terms of sexuality, are you drawn to that? The studies were shocking.
Why?
The highest level of male arousal was between like 17 and 23. Why would that be the case?
Isn't that because that was always the age that men started to take wives and get married?
But that's the sociological reason.
Relations.
That's the sociological. But what's the biological reason? The biological reason is that these girls are like extremely fit.
Yeah.
So the chances of them losing a child is very low.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah, it's mostly biological. The sociological layering on top, that has very little influence on the genes.
And the women, what were they interested in?
It's funny because this study was really revealing. Women, what they were drawn to had very little correlation to what they said they wanted. Yeah.
We were talking about that just before.
It was very little correlation because women are taught that if you like the bad boy, you're going to be ostracized from society. Mm-hmm. Right. If you like a certain type of archetype, you're going to be written off as bad and nasty.
Right. Mm.
So, but the good guys, the soft guys, the gentle, they showed very little arousal to those type of images.
Cool. That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
Who'd want to date a wimp?
This is what it is. But so this is why the kind of woke mob is coming in conflict with science. And this is why science is being challenged.
So I saw for the first time the other day, because I'm not really down with the lingo that Gen Z uses. And I've got friends who've got kids who are like in their teens now. The way they talk, you need a translator. Mm. But there's this thing that guys say, I'm simping for this girl.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And I've never heard this before, so I had to like figure out what this means. These guys are willing to be a simp for this girl because they think that turns the girl on. They think that's the right place for them to be socially.
Yep.
That's obviously, that's performance. Mm. That's not true, right?
Yeah, it's not sustainable either.
And the girl isn't that into a simp.
No. In any case, well, you may be for signaling purposes. Remember.
For what? For other women?
Yes, for other people in society. There are communities to go, I'm with someone who's sort of non-binary. I'm with someone. So these signaling pressures have extraordinary influence on our decision-making. But the question becomes, what happens behind the scenes over time? Mm. And are you chasing someone on the side for your deeper primitive kind of instincts?
I honestly could talk to you about 100,000 things now, but I do want to go back to something you and I got into a DM conversation about on WhatsApp. Because really, I mean, I'm lucky that I know Timothy and I can tap into his unbelievable knowledge and experience of all of the stuff that he's just revealed a tiny piece of today. But we were talking about signaling, essentially. And you know, there's a lot of political signaling going on in the world at the moment. I mean, it's telling that, you know, Kamala Harris won't do a single interview at the moment. And she's gone from being an embarrassment to the administration, where they were just kind of shuffling her off to the border and then kind of hiding her in her office, and she was playing solitaire and stuff. Now she's the unbelievable woman who's on the cover of Time magazine, and it says her moment, and everyone's rallying behind her, and the media falling into lockstep behind her and everything too. And one of the big things that has come out of this is people are saying, who don't like Kamala, they're saying, oh, she's just a DEI hire, right? Mm-hmm. And in some ways, she's never won an election. She's never even stood for a major election. She doesn't have any credentials to speak of. There are no great achievements in her political career. Joe Biden even said when he selected her, I need a woman of color, which is so patronizing that for people who are not on the left, this sounds like a DEI hire. Mm. And for people who are on the left, now you can't say she's a DEI hire because that's insulting. So you're wrong on both sides.
This,
what do we make of this? Because that's a kind of signaling too. People are signaling to their tribe.
Yeah. If we were to line up all of our presidents throughout history, we've had some that are not so bright. And partially it's because you want people in position who are more symbolic. It's not necessarily about their ability to execute, because they're not a CEO. You have checks and balances. There's actually not much you can do as an individual. And people miss this. It's all symbolic. Kamala Harris, if she were to sit down with you, you'd probably be blown away. Kamala comes from extraordinary stock. Her father is an economist, a hailed economist from, I think, Stanford. She doesn't come from weak stock. What you get is sound bites and goofy laughing and all that sort of stuff. But she's not I'd say if you put her in a room against prime George Bush, you'd probably have a better conversation with her. So my point is that what she is a symbol for the overcorrection that's happening. So the overcorrection is happening around the world, throughout Europe, throughout America, is that there was an exporting, and there's an extraordinary implication to this. There was an exporting of culture, or exporting of what we call soft power, around the world through colonialism and other ventures where people wanted to share their worth and their value to the rest of the world. And now the world is correcting for it. If you are going to share your language and your cultural values with some piece of the world, what makes you think they're not going to come back to you
with that piece of
it? Well, just to be drawn to it, if nothing else.
Okay.
Just on a fundamental, basic level, if you're going to go to this remote part of the world, and this part of the world struggles to develop because of what I call deracination. Deracination is when, if you are a country and you're forced to operate on split value systems, so half of your mind is working in English, the other half is working in some Asian language, then you may struggle as a society in certain areas. And so it takes longer if you operate in a deracinated mindset to develop at times. And so if someone comes from that deracinated culture, they're like, you know what? I got a better chance of going back to where there's this culture that has been exported to us to thrive there, because they look like they're thriving, there's more job opportunities, et cetera. So this is a boomerang effect that the world is experiencing, and Kamala is becoming the face of it. And so people are pushing it, not because of her. People don't really give a damn about Kamala. It's that for 500 years, we men, and this is not about patriarchy, be very clear about this. This is much more intense than that. We men created laws where if a woman went to court, there needed to be two women to be considered one man in some societies. And those societies still exist, where women could not inherit land. And so the brothers got an extraordinary leap forward. So the world is correcting for this now. And it's happening all over the world. And she has become this smiling, laughing person because she embodies so much of the correction.
You think it's an overcorrection?
I do think it's overcorrection. It's almost like this extraordinary wave of energy is hitting back the world, and we'll figure it out. There's going to be some mistakes, and there's going to be a huge, she may be a mistake if she becomes president. But the point is, the correction often is messy.
I think that's interesting. I mean, in South Africa, we've now had 30 years of a different kind of system than we had prior to 94.
Yeah.
A very different system where, you know, people are criticizing what's happened in the last 30 years, but we also forget very quickly what happened before that.
Yeah. Mm.
And we only remember, we were talking, Jack and I, earlier about how nobody's really moaning about Eskom at the moment because we haven't had load shedding and no one's going, oh, well done, Eskom.
Yeah.
We just carry on like, yeah, this is exactly the norm. We have such short memories. And I wonder how things like DEI, in the case of South Africa, affirmative action, BEE, how those things are starting to be worked through by societies. Yeah. Because 30 years is enough time to be able to pick up on trends, mm, to be able to say, well, this is working for those reasons. These are not working for those reasons. This could work better for that. How do you feel about that kind of thing, especially in a South African context? Because you help people navigate these things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me give you a U.S. example. Since we're talking about Kamala Harris, and it will come to South Africa. So on day one of the Biden and Harris administration, they passed a policy called Executive 13985. If you speak to anybody in America, they have no clue what this is.
Yeah.
But essentially, it's a DEI equity policy. And the idea was the U.S. gives out about $780 billion in contracts. You know what percentage of those contracts go to Black people? 1.6%. Almost a trillion in contracts. Mm-hmm. Now, I started looking at who are the people getting the biggest contracts. The people who get the biggest contracts is this organization called Lockheed. They were started in 1926.
The aeronautics company.
Yes.
Right? Lockheed Martin.
Yes. Yeah. And they were started in 1920s. Now, at that time, they were building extraordinary, what we call legacy relationships. They're brilliant, by the way. Mm. You know, at the end of the day, they provide extraordinary defense contracts, et cetera, sure, to the U.S. government. They're brilliant. But the heads and the people who have built those relationships are so entrenched, it'd be very difficult to open those up to other people. So they become almost like bloodline relationships. Now, this is very important. How do you penetrate bloodline relationships? It's almost impossible. At the end of the day, if I'm a Black engineer who we work with in the States through an organization called MBDA, this guy has so many patents, he can't crack that bloodline dynamic. So guess what? He has to leverage Executive Order 13985 to get in. And he's not saying, I'm not trying to replace these people. I just want a piece of the $49 billion in contracts you get.
No, I mean, I don't think anyone would, having had the explanation you've given, have a problem with that.
But we don't have that conversation because we don't know it, number one.
Right.
And all we go is DEI is bad, 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 or merit is good, good, good. We don't have a sophisticated enough conversation to tackle these subjects. You know, I was on the phone last night with a young lady named Owetu in Soweto. And Owetu was crying because some say she lost her mother because her mother was giving birth in the home to a child, and she and the baby died.
Oof. That's awful.
And I know Owetu. Owetu is 17. I know Owetu because I had helped her mom publish a book years ago. And Owetu reached out to me when she was 15 and was like, I don't know if you remember me, but I was a child. You helped my mom, and something told me to reach back out to you. And we were in a really fascinating conversation because she was talking about her father's grappling with alcoholism, can't get deals, can't get this, can't get that, whatever. And I was thinking about contrasting her life's journey and trajectory with another young lady named Kanye. Now, Kanye comes from the same community in Soweto. And Kanye is, but a little bit worse because Kanye was a orphan. Both of her parents died of HIV. Hmm. Now, Kanye ended up, because of affirmative action in South Africa, getting a scholarship she ended up going to, or a bursary, ended up going to Cape Town, UCT, end up with this extraordinary job. Well, she first went to the Oprah School and with this extraordinary job at Investec. And I was thinking about how one of these communities was exposed, one of these people in this community was exposed to affirmative action and the other one wasn't. And nobody is talking about how affirmative action is lifting so many people out of in education.
Because the people who don't like it will only cite the bad examples.
Remember, the first wave of affirmative action didn't have all this education stuff in it. It was just certain individuals making a lot of money from it.
And that's what people look at.
Yes.
Right? And they go, oh, well,
such got rich off this.
There's these five people who were allied to the.
But what I would like to see is I'd like to see somebody do a report on what affirmative action has done to educate people in this country. And I'd really love to see that. It may be out there, but I doubt it. I doubt we have tracked the Kanyes and looked at the extraordinary impact. And because, like you said, we're not having these conversations because we're so focused on the problem. And we should be focused on problems. Yes, we should be focused on the bad part of DEI. We should be focused on the bad part of affirmative action.
I mean,
additionally to tracking the Kanyes, I think it's also important to track the Kanyes who don't take full advantage of affirmative action. Because again, like for me, it always comes down to the choice that a person has to eventually make. It's either you're going to take the opportunity that is in front of you or you're not.
What do you hope to achieve by tracking those?
I think I'd like to see if there's a genuine betterment to those people's lives. If there isn't, because if it turns out that even though affirmative action is handed out to, let's just say, 10 people, if the country, we could minimize the numbers to the point whereby it's, we represent black people as 10 people, right? And six of them live below the poverty line. You give affirmative action to help four of them. If two make it and two don't, then we can split the difference and keep moving. But if three of them fail and only one makes it, then we have to have a different conversation about the culture, right?
Well, I got into this conversation. I interviewed Penwell the other day, and he's a really, regardless of whether you agree with him or not on everything, because we always have to say this to people. I don't have to say it to you two, but you have to say this to people, right? Like some of the morons in the comment section. I love you guys. He and I got into a conversation afterwards. Jack was in the room about what people deserve, right? Based on their life choices. Mm. And like, there are things that life throws at you that are not your fault, that happen to you because of circumstances.
Like Owetu. It's not her fault that her mom died in front
Absolutely.
Of her giving birth.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can always bring that hard line idea that, well, you know, your circumstances, you can't choose, but you can choose how you react to them. Sure, if you've got the wherewithal, most people are living in survival mode.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's not always possible. And he made me feel like I was being dishonest because he said to me, do you think that people deserve what they get in life? And I really had to think about it for a whole week before I got back to him yesterday. And we've carried on the conversation. I don't even know if he wants me to talk about this, but we're doing it anyway. So
yeah,
I said to him, I've thought about this for a while. There are two kind of deserve is a very difficult word to to come to terms with, because there are things that come about as a result of your choices, which is what I think Jack was alluding to here. That's why I bring this up. And if bad things happen because of your choices, you deserve the outcome of that, good or bad, because you made the choices. To sit there and not make choices is probably the very worst kind of thing to let happen.
But then that within agency. Itself is a choice. Yeah,
you lack agency. But if things have happened to you that are not your fault, it would be completely immoral of me or anyone else to say you deserve whatever happens to you. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, there's an earthquake and get buried under rocks, or you're in the World Trade Center on 9/11/2001. It can't be your fault that terrible things happen to you after that.
Yeah.
And you can't deserve that. Mm-mm. Do you think that that's a distinction worth making a difference about?
I don't know that we are intelligent enough to even have this conversation. And let me give you the reason why. The way society is designed and the extraordinary forces that are influencing us, you have no idea just how much how many choices you think you're making that you're not making. And if you look at Robert Sapolsky, you look at Sam Harris and all these extraordinary neuroscientists that are starting to say, we don't even...
consciousness.
We don't even... Like, this thing is so much more complex. And let me give you a couple examples. During the Hurricane Katrina relief efforts, they wanted to see who was giving most to the relief efforts. And it turns out that people whose name rhymed with Katrina or whose names had a similar initial pattern as Katrina gave more on average. I want everybody listening to go and do an audit of your friends. You're going to be shocked at how many people you're drawn to that you think you love, you think you're drawn to, but it's because of simple bullshit like initials. It's a simple nonsense like the sound of their name has made you feel comfortable, less anxiety in the brain. I don't know if we're having the best conversation about these.
That is amazing. And just to go back to the affirmative action thing, I heard another interesting thing about that the other day. I've heard that this has been a gift to white people. Mm. I'm sure you've heard this theory.
Yeah.
Is that because white people can't sit and hope for the government to save them, that in this country, a lot of them have had to
Innovate,
be entrepreneurs, start their own businesses because they won't get a job. I think in America at the moment, they've just worked out like on the latest statistics in terms of employment, I think it's 6 to 8% of white people in America have been employed by major companies. That in America, it's obviously the reverse of here in terms of population dynamics. Mm-hmm. But what that does is it then forces those people to man up, to stand up, to be counted, to make their difference in society, where before they might have been able to just fit in somewhere and, you know, got through the HR department's interview easily enough and they're ticking a number and you can stick around. I mean, that's one of the unintended consequences of policy.
Yeah, right? We call it edge effects where when a particular species is dying in nature, you'll find, for example, a new species will arise. And that's what's happening in white people. A new sort of identity is arising.
A new species of white people.
Yeah, a new species. You guys are evolving.
Oh, Jesus. All right, that's all you needed to hear. You watch some black guys. I dedicated my whole life to fighting white people, and now they've been turning a new species. What bullshit is this?
I'm telling you. It's crazy.
I mean, that's interesting. I was watching the Olympics and I want to have your thoughts on this because I'm pretty obsessed. I'll be over it next week, I promise. But watching these incredible specimens. And again, you know, this just proves we're one species. And anyone who thinks like there is a place for any of that Darwinist bullshit has to acknowledge that you saw fast black people and fast white people. You saw tall black people and tall white people. You saw strong black and white people. I mean, it is like the best of humanity. And it gave me such joy inside to know that all the bullshit that the politicians in particular are constantly proffering us about, like, you're oppressed, you're no good, you're great, you should be kept down, you should be helped up. Like, actually, it's all mostly nonsense. Like your example of the team guy earlier with the mustache and his team that didn't get him. And then you corrected one little thing and suddenly they got each other.
Yeah.
Like, I got something out of the Olympics. Yeah, do you agree?
Same. Yeah, yeah. The Olympics were fascinating. One of the things that I realized is that the Olympics are mostly an aggregation of outliers though. Mm. So if your lung capacity is a bit different from another, or your ability to have a hip to waist ratio, et cetera. And it's interesting because if you look at this kind of XY chromosome dynamic and the fact that there's some people who just have their biology sits on the edge of something, you become either you have an ability to compete in an extraordinary way, or you don't necessarily have a place to anybody else to compete with.
Yeah.
And it's a very unique time in society where we're starting to be able to measure these things in ways that we weren't in the past. We're starting to be able to give labels to people who are on the extremes, et cetera. I mean, I had a chance to interview once Carl Lewis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Carl was interesting for me because when he was hosted by De Beers and I interviewed him in Botswana and we were talking about his success back then. And he was just basically like, you know, if you look at his race, his 100, the slowest person that ran in 2024 Olympics beat his time.
Yeah. Right.
That's how much we are advancing.
Yeah.
Because we understand the body more. We're able to speak to those various elements. So we're in an interesting time in history where we're learning, we're evolving. And I'm sharing with everybody, I don't care how smart you are, you should hold certainty lightly because we're about to go into an age of explosive insights about the body, about the mind.
Some certainty. Not all.
Well, I would say there's not much I was certain about maybe 10 years ago than I'm as certain about now.
But isn't that also an effect that of getting older? But yeah. Also, when as you get older, you realize, like, I actually know shit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like, there are the things that I was so sure about. I could have told you everything when I was 25.
Exactly.
Now I'm like, I need to talk about this
exactly.
one.
Exactly.
By the way, you're getting a lot of shit in the comments from people who say you're a vegan and that explains everything. It's a lot of abuse of veganism.
Yep.
Some comments about the affirmative action stuff, but that's
can I tell you why I'm a vegan? Story. Does anybody care?
Well,
yeah,
I was
go
a
on.
Vegan for a bit, so I want to hear your story. Let's hear
so it. I have a cousin that plays for the NBA named Chris Paul, who is like...
Chris Paul is not your cousin.
Don't be a hater.
CP3's
your
You've
got
cousin?
Famous family as well. Relax.
Oh, my so, God.
I like the way you just dropped that in there.
Oh,
yeah,
my
that's
God.
That's quite a thing, actually.
So, did Gareth, you hear him? He's like,
Gareth, do you even
Paul.
Know who Chris Paul is?
I do know who Chris
oh,
Paul is.
Oh, okay.
What?
Gareth.
Jesus, how do you keep that secret and I've known you for 10 years?
What oh, the wow. hell? You don't just drop that?
Son okay. of a bitch.
Listen, we don't have much time. Let me dive in.
Okay, all right.
So he went vegan, turned his entire career around because veganism helps reduce inflammation. And so I am like a prolific athlete. I know I don't look like it, so don't look at me funny. But I play paddle, tennis, basketball, and I'm one of the best shooters in the country in basketball. And you
Which
can go to
country?
My Instagram. Actually, probably globally, actually. I think I'm in the top 5% in basketball.
So much for not being certain.
I'm going to go.
So much for certainty.
Guys, my nickname is 80%. So anyway, I was getting injured. So I was like, let me try this veganism like my cousin. And I haven't gotten injured. And my recovery time is so quick. That's why. That's it. So for all the haters, come play me in a paddle.
Holy shit. I'm just looking at Chris Paul's like record here. It's incredible.
Yeah, he's one of the greatest.
He's one of the greatest point guards to ever step on the court.
Yeah, so he's from North Carolina. Yeah, North Carolina boys.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
All right. So the other interesting thing we got into conversation about was the Secret Service in your family. Because this was around the time of the assassination attempt on Trump. Yeah. Yeah. And when we were both talking about how, you know, you had these like fat girls who were like supposed to be bodyguards and working for the Secret Service. And I was saying to you then, like, that's DEI at work because you got these ladies. And it was true that the Secret Service boss, who's now resigned, said, I'm here to bring up the numbers of the girls in the Secret Service. Like, woo, girl bosses. It's like they've watched too many fucking Barbie movies or something.
Yeah.
And then when someone actually tries to kill a presidential candidate, then she's hauled in front of Congress and asked some very sensible questions. Mm-hmm. But because she's a woman, some people are like, oh, that's unfair. They were very aggressive and hostile with her. She's the boss of the Secret Service.
Yeah.
She's not there to like look after how pretty the office looks.
No. Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you're going to be putting yourself in that position, you're going to be treated by the people around you with the same level of respect and the same disrespect that they would give to a guy in that position.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think you said earlier, like women will say they want this, but they actually want that because they're actually signaling to other women mostly where they fit into the pecking order. Because female hierarchy is very different to male hierarchy.
Sure.
Yep.
And community and cooperation and all that stuff really is important and way more important to women. It's not to say it isn't important to us, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a thing that happens where women will say they want to be the CEO, but then they don't want to make the decisions.
Mm.
And I'm not saying this is true. There are loads of very effective female CEOs. Again, you have to keep bringing these.
You have to
put these caveats in because otherwise people think, oh, you're just some bigot who doesn't care. Like, I'm looking at the subtleties here. I don't want to talk about what tribe you belong to. I'm the non-DEI tribe or I'm the DEI tribe.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to talk about I'm a feminist or I'm not a feminist. I want to go into the nuances and figure out why it is. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I don't want to be one of those people who just says it's because of the individual in question.
Yeah.
Because that's not always the case, right, Timothy?
Yeah. I mean, we got into the conversation because my family has three generations of Secret Service. A great uncle and then another aunt, and then now my cousin. My cousin is in her, I think this is her 20th year, and she's a captain. And, you know, I don't know if either of them would have become Secret Service agent if it wasn't for some policy where they needed more Black people back then. Mm. But I will say that my cousin, who's a captain, is extraordinary. And it's an interesting dynamic to me because there is this tension between the people who get in who are not as good and the people who get in and take advantage of it. And so that tension is always going to be there when you're correcting for a system, for a systemic issue.
So the worst thing I could do then is say that your cousin was a DEI hire, because clearly this is now third generation stuff, the bloodline.
Well, that's why I was saying to you in the chat stuff, that the first person was probably DEI hire.
Sure, and he may not have been as good. Maybe. Yes, maybe exactly. He was terrific.
Maybe he was, but he wasn't.
Because there are DEI people, and I see a lot of comments on this going on while we're talking, but because there will be people who are put in just for those reasons, inevitably the people who are critical of that system will say, well, look, they're not so good. And what it does is it actually hurts the people who are Black and in it for the right reasons. It doesn't hurt the white people.
Yeah.
It doesn't hurt the Black people.
Yeah.
It hurts the ones who are good.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who should least be punished get punished.
Because, I mean, even themselves, like having to walk on a university campus and you feel like you don't belong necessarily because you are a DEI. You get what I mean?
Yeah.
There's multiple ways that this thing could go completely wrong. I would love for, you know, the world to be a meritocracy. We also need to address things that happened in the past. It's just, I'm not sure where the happy medium is.
Well, let me just say this. I can't leave this conversation today without talking about how everyone listening, including us, are retarded in perspective when it comes to our understanding of any of this stuff. And let me share why. I want everybody to consider going and doing an audit of the people they follow and do an audit of their echo chambers.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched Jordan Peterson almost cripple his extraordinary mind because of echo chambers. I've watched him fall and follow libs of TikTok, all of this stuff, to a point where he doesn't realize. And I had on my podcast two professors who worked with him in University of Toronto for years. And what their theory is that before he was on social media, his balance of perspective and input helped him regulate his output in a way that made him famous. And now that he's been removed from that system, what he is experiencing mostly from perspective on social media on a daily is focusing him to a particular angle that is not a healthy view of the world. It is a narrow, small percentage of wild, exaggerated examples. And so his two colleagues were like, what his example has shown them is to stay off social media, because what it's doing is forcing you into these echo chambers where all you see is the worst examples of DEI, the worst examples of this.
And that would be good advice for all of us, actually, because what you put in, you're going to get out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's repeats, like any machine.
Yes. And Stanford, if you look at the people who have designed most of these algorithms, they've designed them on the highest priority of your primitive self.
Mm-hmm.
So your primitive nature has high levels of priority around sexuality, survival, etc. So they have created this model called, you put hot triggers in the path of motivated people. So those hot triggers are being replicated in your algorithms. And it's not just an algorithm. I'm tired of that word even. It is intensified hot triggers that if you hate trans, you're going to see a whole lot more of it if you stay in these echo chambers.
Absolutely. And and you can see it because the in-group stuff that people are inclined to follow now just reinforces their already strongly held beliefs.
Yes. And it exaggerates and retards those beliefs.
How do you, just because I can't let you go. I know we've run over a little bit here, but we could do whatever we want, right?
Yeah, it's your...
belong to anybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
How do we prevent that from happening? And you may be a big Jordan Peterson fan, and maybe you think what Timothy said is nonsense.
But Jordan is incredible. That's not the point. Jordan is incredible.
I happen to agree that there's been a change in him.
Yeah, there's a fundamental change.
Anyone can see. You watch something he was doing in one of his lectures 5-6 years ago. I interviewed him then, and you listen to him now. It's a different guy, and we all change. So it's not a criticism.
Yeah.
But how can we all guard against becoming victims of our in-group and our input holding us to ransom?
Can I be honest? I'm losing hope. And let me tell you, because unless something happens at a policy level with these social media companies, it's becoming almost impossible. If someone as smart as Jordan Peterson has fallen for this, what hope do I have over here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Putella says, I enjoy some of Jordan Peterson's content, but lately it's like he's developed a bit of a messiah complex. Mm-hmm. What is going on with him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, again, I mean, there are people here who criticize you and they say, well, you only say this stuff because you're vegan.
Yeah. Well, this is the point. Let me tell you where the moments where I've been losing hope. I've been losing hope, for example, in my LinkedIn. So I used to be able to hack LinkedIn. So what I used to do, let's say I go on Metro FM, I would get a lot of followers from Black people. And then what would happen is LinkedIn would start only showing me Black people.
Yeah.
The assumption is because I'm adding these Black people, that's all I want. Mm. So I would go on and add random Indians just to get some Indians.
Yeah.
I needed some Indians. It worked, but it's starting to work less. It's extraordinary.
The machine is getting better at figuring out how to not let you hack it.
Exactly. It's getting better, and it's starting to look at older patterns. It used to kind of work on short-term patterns. So if only whites were adding me today and I needed a few more Black people to kind of balance out my inputs.
Your quota.
My inputs.
Free Karl Marx of you, by the way. So, I need to balance my Blacks and whites.
Yeah. So let me tell you why this is important. Because if I ask you, Gareth, as smart as you are, to name three counter versions of smart people like Jordan in America, could you? I'm talking about professors from elite universities like Harvard, like Stanford and Yale. Could you?
Yeah, probably could. I mean, people would hate them. People wouldn't say that they were equal or opposite and equal to him.
And I'm not talking about the Thomas Sowell's. I'm talking about people.
No. I was going to say people like Robin DiAngelo, you know,
okay,
who I know is completely on the other side of things. And a lot of people say, well, she's just an idiot race hustler, and she may well be, but I can name her.
Yeah.
And I mean, you mentioned Kamala's dad, who was a Marxist professor of economics.
Yeah.
There used to be such kinds of, you know, contradictions in terms in those days, but you could talk about these things. And certainly, I mean, in academia, you're spoiled for choice if you're looking for the opposites of Jordan. Well, so, one of the reasons he stood out, I think, is because he took positions on things which broadly in academia were frowned upon.
My issue is that when you enter these echo chambers, what happens is you start to replicate the people that you are attracted to, right? You start to replicate them, and you assume it's only them that exist.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I'm losing hope is that I'm finding, and I haven't completely lost hope. I see it in my paddle community that I try to build a diverse community because I enjoy networking. I'm spending up to 50% of my year in the States now. So oftentimes when I come back to South Africa to work, I find that I struggle to expand my network, and I'm using paddle to do it. And it's the best place. Like, I've got Indian, Jewish, all types of people that I play paddle with. But it's becoming harder and harder and harder. So I've had to change the type of photos that I use.
Can I tell you what I do?
What?
I look for fights.
Okay.
That helps.
Okay.
Because when you deliberately seek out conflict, you will keep yourself on your toes. It's like a boxer has to box with people who are at their level.
Yeah.
And I think you have to deliberately, and people have a, we have an inbuilt desire to avoid conflict. Most of us, there are some weird psychopaths out there, but I go out of my way to find and meet and sit with and talk to people I disagree with.
The hardest part about paddle is that you connect with people in open matches. So the way
I
works,
don't want to play paddle. Well, okay. I look for fights.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I'm telling you, I will, and not online. I'm telling you, and if I hear someone at a table next door to me in a restaurant say something that I completely agree with, it's none of my business. I should shut up and just carry on eating my food. Mm. But I turn around and go, what did you just say?
Mm.
Sometimes it doesn't end well.
Sure.
I haven't had a fist fight breakout.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It forces me and them to share ideas which otherwise would be siloed off from each other.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. So, I mean, that's just one way. And paddle's too friendly. You need to get into, like, conflict situations.
Yeah.
I
go to a war zone.
I don't agree with Gareth on this. Like, honestly, over this past, like, the long weekend, I was with a couple of my friends. And we are on polar opposites of the Trump issue, the Kamala issue. And we spent hours going at it. Now, not only am I more entrenched in my beliefs, I think I kind of pulled apart a few of theirs. You know what I mean? Like that level of exchange of ideas kind of helps you understand
how well.
Would go have a beer with these guys after?
Yeah, of course.
Awesome.
So, of course.
So here's an interesting thing. I don't want to end the show on a very serious note. And I want you to also plug your podcast and the books that you've already done, the books that you're busy with. So Carl says, I cannot believe this show is going to end without asking Timothy why men find tits so lekker. You know, we do the important work on this show. So can you help us understand why tits are so lekker for men?
Okay, so there are multiple reasons.
Mm.
And by the way, for the people who are into booties, which are most heterosexual people around the world, there's no society on earth where a flat, flat bum is hot. So there's a little bit of perk, a little bit of perk that's attractive. You find exaggerated perks, which we call supernormal stimuli, to be hot as well. But there's a link between the booty and the breast that is not many people know about. So if you look at the nutrients inside of breast milk, they come from various fat deposits across a woman's body. And so there are certain fat deposits that produce the nutrients that nurture a child's heart. There's nutrients that nurture a child's lungs, nurture a child's brain. The nutrients in the hips and buttocks nurture a child's brain.
Hmm.
So there's a strong genetic link to the curvature in that area to assume that.
So the bigger the ass, the smarter the baby.
Yeah. And so now here's where it becomes.
I think there was a song about that.
Once. Yeah. Well, here's where it becomes really interesting.
I like big butts of against my lie. On the other hand, deny.
When a girl works hard with an itty bitty waist and a round thing in your face,
you get sprung.
So now, if you link that to the breast, that becomes like this automatic, you know, association between being able to nurture the child. So even if you have no interest in child or in a child, or you had no interest in trying to get somebody pregnant, that the assumption is that that person's, this woman's breast and the hip to waist ratio creates a value proposition for you.
And so, let's be honest, they're just great to look at.
My pussy and my crack. I mean, we can carry on all day. I got songs. Listen, I love having
going
you here.
And
what I like about the conversations I get to have with you far too seldom, I'm afraid, is that we so often disagree, but I learn fantastically cool shit from you.
Yeah.
And I don't want that to stop. It's one of the reasons I get super excited when you're on the show.
Yeah, I enjoyed the back and forth because, you know, not agreeing with someone should have nothing to do with your ability to have good conversation.
Yeah, I'm right. And to even like those people. Unfortunately, your home country, again, like there are people now who will not talk to each other because one member of the family's Democrat and the other member's a Republican, and they won't talk to each other. And that is sad.
Yeah.
Because there used to be this unspoken thing that the most hardcore congressmen and women would go for drinks after – work and sit in the same bar and laugh and talk to each other. Famously, there are marriages, you know, Carvel and his wife, who are like Republican and Democrat, and they love each other, but they can still argue. And argument does not mean conflict and hostility.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
It actually, the act of arguing is a way of both of you improving your minds.
Yeah,
that's it.
If it's done properly.
That's really what cafes were designed for in Europe, is to host people over good coffee.
Lies that were developed so that communists could get together and talk. Some fucking capitalists to pay for their coffee.
Man, thanks so much for having me. This has been great.
All right, Thank you guys so much. Find out more by following Timothy on the socials, and we'll put all those on the description below. But just tell people about what else you're busy with so that they can follow you. If they loved this, there's much more with it.
Yeah. Thank you. So if you want to grab my books, I would actually recommend Personovation. It's been my best. It's been reprinted like 8 times. But the reason why I'd recommend that book is that the question I was answering in that book is, what happens when you outgrow your current self? And there is often this extraordinary conflict between, you want to hold on to the best of your old self, but you can feel yourself evolving. So that book is called Personovation. You can get that on Kindle. Just download that on Kindle. I think you may be able to find a free copy of it. And what I'm working on now is a book called, I'm going to just give the title because it's going to force me to finish this thing, called Arouse. Mm-hmm. And it's about that nexus between what's happening internally in your body and your hormones and what's happening sociologically to you. And it's how to resolve that sort of conflict, and how brands leverage it, and how leaders leverage it, how politicians leverage that tension, because it's unresolved and it's largely a mystery to us. And so, let's hang out on social media. I talk a lot of nonsense. I've been into gym lately. I saw you've been working out as well. I think we both feel mortality sense.
So, right. Exactly.
So we're just kind of trying to give it one last shot.
Before we're put out to pasture and we're no longer desirable. Jesus, it's coming quick, people.
Yeah.
All right, Timothy Maurice, thank you very much. Jack, so good. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And we had a lot of fun, a lot of ridiculousness in the first hour and a lot of sensible stuff in the second hour. I love it.
Yeah, it's a balance.
All right. We will see you on Friday, bright and early at 6 a.m. But don't forget, we've also got the Burning Platform on the podcast party tomorrow. So go over there for that. Come back here for this. We'll, you know, if you haven't worked it out by now, I can't help you. I'm not here to, what am I here to, tit feed your baby?
Thank you. You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?